Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharakana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we're joined by our guest, Shonda Buchanan.
A Pushcart Prize nominee, Oxfam Ambassador, USC Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities Fellow, and a City of Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs Master Artist Fellow, Shonda Buchanan is the author of 5 books, including the award-winning memoir, Black Indian. An award-winning poet, fiction, nonfiction writer, and educator, Shonda has been a journalist for 25 plus years, publishing in the Los Angeles Times, the LA Weekly, AWP's The Writer's Chronicle, Los Angeles Times Magazine, Indian Country Today, and the International Review of African American Art. President of Beyond Baroque, Literary Art Center's Board of Trustees, Shonda is also a Sundance Institute Writing Arts Fellow, a Penn Center Emerging Voices Fellow, and a Gentile Artist Residency Fellow.
Finalist for the 2021 Mississippi Review Poetry Contest, Shonda's memoir, Black Indian, won the 2020 Indie New Generation Book Award and was chosen by PBS NewsHour as a 20 books to read to learn about institutional racism. Shonda is also the newest fiction faculty member in Alma College's MFA program. Writing on Tongva, Chumash land, Shonda is currently shopping her book of poetry about Nina Simone. Shonda Buchanan, welcome to Speak On It.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm incredibly grateful to be on your show.
Thank you so much for being here. So Shonda, what were some of the stories we mentioned in the bio that you wrote the book Black Indian? What were the stories you heard growing up about your family's Native Indigenous ancestry?
So my first stories growing up about my American Indian ancestry came from my mom. And my mom would always say, and I write this in the book too, she would always say, you know, you have some Indian in you, some French and some German and a little bit of Black. And, you know, that was kind of my research question when I really started thinking about our ethnicity and the mixture that we were. Sometimes she would call herself, my mom would call herself a mutt. Hmm. And I was like, wait, does that mean I'm a mutt too? Like, I don't really like that term.
Right.
So I really started thinking about where are these Indigenous American Indian ancestors? Really, it was more them. It wasn't really looking for the French and the German. That seemed a bit ancillary since I didn't appear white or I didn't appear European, like I wasn't visibly European.
Right.
And the Black part was just kind of always there. So the first stories really came, the first languaging of it came from my mother. And then my siblings would say it, my aunts would say it, my grandparents, not so much because I really wasn't around my grandparents a lot, unfortunately. But my grandpa, my grandfather, you know, there were moments where he would exhibit what we thought of as quote unquote, how can I say this? Kind of like the habits of being an Indian person or an Indigenous person. Mm. I write a little bit about that as well. But so yeah, that's my first introduction to those stories and those narratives were through my mom and my siblings and my aunts.
When you say that he would exhibit some of like his Native or Indigenous heritage, could you remember like one thing that he would do?
So I'm going to tell you a few things, and these aren't necessarily the positive things or aspects of it, but my grandfather was an alcoholic And, you know, there has always been that lore, the story that American Indians physiologically cannot handle alcohol. Mm. And then also there's the story of the narratives, actually, and these are true, where American Indians would be given alcohol, you know, to get them inebriated, to sign treaties, you know, and, you know, those kinds of things. So I didn't really correlate any of that until I was older, like, oh, my grandfather was a horrible alcoholic. You know, he was just really lost a lot of the family land because of his own, his alcoholism. And then the other piece was he was a fisherman. You know, he was always like fishing and always, and we lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan anyway, which is where we were born and raised, which is the Great Lakes State. So, you know, everybody's pretty much I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of folks, you know, are fishing.
Right.
It's the culture. That was the culture, right? But he also had a bait house. He sold bait. So there were things that felt, when I finally started going to American Indian reservations, and I was like, wait a minute, that looks like how my grandfather used to, you know, roll. That looks like how my grandpa used to keep a couple of refrigerators full of like bait, like dirt and bait, you know, and I would see some of the same things on American Indian reservations. So it was really interesting to have some of that come together when I started venturing out, you know, into the world.
Very interesting. And there's so many questions that I have out of that, but we'll stick with this one. How did you get started in uncovering your family's Native ancestry?
So going back to my mom, that's a great question, because going back to my mom and her giving us what she heard, right? This is what she heard who we were. And at 16 or 17, I wrote in one of my journals, I wrote a list, because I'm a big list maker. As a poet, as an educator, as a writer, I've got all these dreams and whatnot. And at 16 or 17, I made a list of the things I wanted to do and the things I wanted to accomplish. And on that list is, I want to find my American Indian ancestors. Hmm. I want to find our American Indian tribes, right? And it's interesting, because I didn't at that time, I'll go back to that list too, because it wasn't necessarily, I'm going to find my African ancestors and my African tribe. And I think because I was just innately, I knew I was African. Like I knew, right. I was Black, you know, I couldn't find, because of enslavement or slavery, that felt like that genealogy felt erased more than, you know, right. Going back to the African continent. That felt like a huge thing for a teenager. But I was on Indian land, in Indian country.
Right.
And for some reason, that felt like that could be easier to trace. And so 17, that's when I wrote the question. And then when I moved to Hampton, Virginia, to work at Hampton University, which is a land grant school, which had an American Indian program, they called it an Indian program that educated I'll give you the real backstory of the program is that the Indian program at Hampton University brought probably about 2,000 plus American Indian students from the plains, from the Virginia area, like a Nottoway, Chirahanka Nottoway, American Indians from that area went to Hampton University in the program. They also had South Dakota, Gravan, American Indians, Cheyenne. I mean, so, wow. So there were a lot of schools, land grant schools, who were trying to, quote unquote, educate American Indians. So I'm at the school and I know they've got an archives for the American Indians. And I start kind of peeking into some of the archives and looking at like the what they wrote about some of the students or some of the work that the students left themselves. And Hampton University has a fantastic American Indian Museum, which actually has a lot of the old like regalia and blankets and they've got a couple of chief like bonnets, war bonnets there. But then I said, you know what, let me really start. That's the other thing too. I was a part of the Wyanoke Association in Hampton, Virginia. The Wyanoke Association was founded by two people who became good friends of mine, Anita Harrell and Hugh Harrell. And the Wyandotte Association was about educating African-Americans and American Indians about those intersections, right? Educating the public about those intersections. And Anita happened to be a librarian at the Hampton Public Library, which is where the first event that I went to was held, but they also had a genealogy library upstairs. Wow. And I was like, this is gold. So I literally spent a summer in that library, tracing and tracking down my ancestors, using ancestry.com for free, familysearch.org for free, printing out documents, going through the genealogy books, looking at the books that in that library, there are a couple of books that had my family history and my family narrative. Mm. So that's, it's such an amazing journey. And I'm actually going to do a workshop about, it'll be my second workshop about probably three parts to it, because there's so much in terms of the kinds of books that I use, the cross-referencing in courtrooms and court documents, court record halls, county register halls. I mean, just so much, right? And that's when I started pulling the strings together, and I found that my manuals on my mom's mom's side were from Sampson County, North Carolina. When I realized that Sampson County, North Carolina was like 2 hours away from me, and I in Virginia, and I said, oh no, I've got to go. Like, I've got to go.
Yeah. You got to answer that call.
Yep. It's like a pull and a call.
And that's what I did consistently. So when I found one of my tribes, I would say, oh, okay, you know what? Let me go to the powwow. Let me go to the powwow and let me see, you know, and meet some of these folks. Right. And that's what happened.
Wow. I'm astounded.
Well, thank you for sharing about Hampton, because I didn't know they had a collection.
I didn't know that either. And it's interesting that it's Virginia, because a friend of like the show and a friend of ours, Rick Murphy, he always says all roads lead to Virginia. So I guess there's some truth to that.
Very true. I'm so glad that they say that it's true, because Virginia is one of the first, if not the first, well, Jamestown, actually. Right. The first kind of settlement or quote unquote city. And then there's Colonial Williamsburg. Right. So I think I like that all roads lead to Virginia. But I also would say all roads lead to, really, it's the isthmus. It's the cusp between North Carolina and Virginia, because a lot of the lines were changed with regards to the different wars that happened. The boundaries that were drawn between South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia are boundaries that were crisscrossed over Indian land and Indian tribes and territories. So I like that.
Right.
Before we move on, quick question for you. As you felt this call and this pull, and you said you were finding your family, what did you feel? Or did you feel like you were being guided? That's always my question. Did you feel like, you know what, they're guiding me, they're leading me?
Absolutely, 100%. I've learned on this research journey that it's a term that I started using in my lectures, blood calls blood. And so, because not only was I searching for my ancestors, they were searching for me.
Yes.
You know, they were looking for me. The being in Hampton, Virginia, going to the research facilities, that's like that real earnest, I need to know who they are. My actual journey in terms of ceremonies started in the mountains of California when I first started going to sweat lodges. Hmm. And I became a part of an intertribal community in the mountains of California. And those folks, it really wasn't even about the documents. It was about, do you have your oral history? Then sure, you can participate in these ways, but you need to watch, like you need to pay attention. because these ways are sacred and they're special and it's all about respect. And so that's what I was doing before I even got to a library. It was, I'm bringing my African and my American Indian ancestors into a sweat lodge. I'm bringing that blood into a sweat lodge, trying to reclaim the culture, reclaim the heritage. And then I started researching. And so it's everything just kind of coalesced. So I felt called. I felt like every step that I took towards them, they were taking towards me.
Mm. That's was powerful. Really powerful. And you know what, too, that this is actually that's like a full circle for me personally, because I was able to reconnect or find my grandfather, my mom's dad, and his wife, who she's actually from El Salvador. She said in Spanish, when we first met, you know, blood calls blood. She said the same exact thing.
Wow.
So there's something, it's very true. It's That's very beautiful. True. Those are potent and powerful words for sure.
And it's speaking even in this interview, you know, with DNA and you being able to identify with that. And as you were speaking, though, I just felt it. I was like, she had to feel something. I'd like to know
That's
that.
Right. That's right. And you have to answer to it. That's the key. Yeah, and something you said too, before we get to the next question, is, you know, you talked about the pull or that call to research your native ancestry. Actually, that brings me to another question too. In terms of naming and terminology, Native, American Indian, Indigenous, is there a proper way or a preference that you have in engaging on the topic?
So I grew up saying Indian, like was another piece of when to one of your other questions, when you said, what are some of the things that you recognize that your grandfather would say? Like my grandfather, my mom, my aunts, we would all say Indian. We didn't have the quote unquote PC terminology in our family. And then again, when I started going to ceremonies, I started going to reservations, we all said Indian, and we still say Indian. In the ceremonies, but for other, you know, folks, it's like American Indian, Native American, Indigenous, First Peoples, you know, any of those terms that give respect to, you know, who occupied these lands first, all of those terms are okay to use. So,
Okay. Yeah, I think a lot of us, many African Americans have the oral history of finding out that, you know, you got some Indian in your family. That's how they would say, or Indian, right? That was like
say Indian?
That was the Black American vernacular.
In the South, that's what my grandmother, that's what they would say.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep. Some people would say that in my family too, Indian, yep.
Mm-hmm. But what you said about, you know, that call to research that, you know, not necessarily, like I knew I was Black, right? You know, I knew that the African ancestry was there. And I remember this conversation kind of coming up and people sort of being accused of being kind of anti-Black or anti-African because maybe they're researching, they're more interested in the, you know, that the Indian blood they got in their family. And I think what you said about being on the land is, it really kind of answers to that and speaks to that, that it's not, you know, like before we accuse people of being anti-Black, I think a lot of it is because there's a more tangible connection in a way, right? Like I'm on the land where these people are from. So, you know, that's much, you know, quote unquote, you know, it could be easier. It could be perceived as being easier than like jumping to a whole nother continent. So I like that you said that because I think a lot of people can probably relate to that.
I think it's interesting too, because, you know, there is that sense of anti-Blackness. There is that sense of, don't you just want to stay Black, you know, Black pride, Black power. And I have literally gotten those questions at talks and readings. But I've also had, some of my Indian friends say, hey, why don't you just claim Indian? Why do you have to say you're Black? And, you know, what, you know, I'm like, those things to me don't feel like they're about racism fully per se. It makes me feel like those things are about identity.
Yeah.
And those kinds of questions are like, why can't you just identify with us and give us all the credit and just stay here, you know? So those questions don't feel like it's about race to me. But then the tandem and the attachment of race is erasure. And that becomes that larger question, the larger the facilitation of an attachment to racism is when the darker skinned Indians can't go to Indian schools, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that has happened. Like in the Kahari tribe, there is a language in one of the documents that I found from one of the Kahari Indians. And he says, we have no Negro blood, which is a lie because there were darker skinned kids going to the schools, and federal governments came in and said, if you have anyone who is Black, part Black in your schools, we're going to take away your money. And so we'll take away the federal dollars and the federal grants. And it's so interesting because in my memoir, I couldn't include all of that historical contextual information. But the next book that I'm working on, I will be including a lot of those insidious moments where laws literally function to erase us and to pull families apart.
Right.
So when people ask me those questions and they say, why can't you just stay Black or why can't you just stay Indian? I don't take it personally. You know, I think you want me to identify with only you, and you want me to stay there. And then I broaden that discussion and I say, okay, historically, we have been indoctrinated to be divisive. And so I will not be divisive. I'm going to claim everything.
I say the same thing, because I have friends that they take a DNA test and they'll focus on one particular part and I'll go, well, what about the rest? And they're like, yeah, but I'm on this. And I just make it very clear. I embrace all of it.
Right.
Because that's who I am. So I embrace all of it.
Right.
Mm. Yep.
Exactly. Exactly.
Go ahead.
No, I'm going to say that our DNA shows that we are really global citizens. You know,
this is true.
The DNA shows it's like when you didn't come from nothing. And when you look at the seven generations, which is, you know, what American Indians, we always think about that seven generation mark. What we're doing right now is something that our ancestors seven generations ago set into motion. And what we're doing today sets the seven generations, whatever is the seven generations from my moment to me, what I'm doing sets that into motion, what they're going to do.
That, that is profound.
Beautiful. And I think that's beautiful.
Can you say it one more time? One more time, seven generations.
Yes. We think in seven generations, which we think about whatever was happening seven generations ago in my ancestors' history, heritage, functioning, interactions, whatever they were doing, set in motion what I am doing seven generations, hints from them. And what I am doing sets in motion what seven generations from now, my grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-greats will be doing, right?
Wow.
That's how we think of. We have to think like that, particularly for the earth, right? Oh my gosh, there are so many conversations we can have around the responsibility of caregivers of the earth and of each other.
That's right. So
the seven generations thinking is it gives you a different sense of responsibility. It gives you a totally different sense of accountability.
It really does.
That's why I asked you to repeat.
It really, really does.
One more time for the people in the back.
It's such a refrain. Yeah, that's like, oh wow, what a gem.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So in your book, Black Indian, you wrote, quote, if my mother knew anything about being Indian, the culture and practices of any Indian tribe, she never told me. Our Indian heritage was oral history. So you kind of touched on this a little bit, but why do you think that happened, that the traditions weren't passed down?
Mm. I'm going to tell you, it's so much. I'll give you three specific reasons. I think because of the ostracization that people of color were experiencing, and particularly, I'll say, I'll just go to my family. My Roberts in in North Carolina, Hampton County, North Carolina, were free people of color. They were labeled as free people of color. This is before the PLC. PLC came from free people of color. Mm-hmm. Colored came from free people of color too. And there's a whole history around that. But my Roberts in North Carolina were free people of color. They owned their own land, which they had inherited from their indentured servant mother. And as time went on, several generations down, the census, the US Census, which was started in 1790, mm-hmm. started recording enslaved people, property, who was in your household, quote unquote. But then if you, they also started at the same time passing laws against miscegenation. So they were called anti-miscegenation laws. So if you married out of your race, you could be fined.
Right.
If you married out of your race, if an indentured woman, a mulatto woman married or had children with a white man or a quote unquote, a Negro at the time, that child could be taken and bonded out, taken from you, because that was a child that you had no right to because you were either enslaved or you were an indentured servant or you were a mixed blood indentured servant. So that child could be taken. So that was one, that sense of ostracization, the sense that your children could be taken from you, mm-hmm. The sense that being a mixed blood person was somehow immoral or illegal or against the quote unquote, the proper laws. Mm-hmm. And then those beliefs and the sensibility just kind of just kept proceeding. And the word is escaping me that I want to say, but just it kept moving forward, ingraining itself into the mm-hmm. social yep. fabric.
Yep.
And so those are things that it just became like, So you mean being a mixed blood is something that I should hide,
right?
Or being Black and Indian or Black and white is something that is punishable. So that belief system became something that functioned within my family when we started leaving the South and the Southeast and hiding. For the Roberts family, they were proud of it. And they always talked about their African and American Indian ancestors. They say our eldest predecessor, our eldest Roberts, an African, a full-blood African man, married a full-blood African, indigenous woman, which they always said she was Cherokee. But from that area, she could have been Cherokee. She could have been Tuscarora. She could have been Maharan. So we don't know what her ancestry is. But then they finally, after moving to Kentucky, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and then Indiana. And when they finally settled in Indiana, they started some of the first free people of color settlements in Indiana, always again, still proud of that ancestry, but it didn't happen for everyone. So right. Other people like my mom and my grandfather and my great grandfather, there were things that they just started like, you don't talk about that. You know, you don't talk about those certain kinds of things. Out of company, like out of the house in mixed company. You don't talk about that.
Right.
And I think that's why we lost our history. That's why we lost our connection. That's why we lost our language. That's why we lost our traditions and our practices, because of the fines, because your children could be taken, because society looked down on mixed race people if you identified and if you actually knew who your people were.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really a head trip. It was an emotional erasure, I think. Definitely a trauma. It was traumatic, you know, to have to deny your kin, you know.
Yeah.
It was trauma. So and then also it was about protection, you know. I'm protecting my family if I don't say certain things.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That makes me think of, there's a book, I believe it's Chosen Exile, and it deals with people passing. And it's so you think of passing, you're like, oh, okay, well, they thought they were all this, but it was really, really sad how some people committed suicide because, or they were, folks would say, well, if you don't give me a certain amount of money, I'm going to tell your secret. And it was just really, really, really some sad stories. So, what are some tips for African Americans trying to verify and uncover their Native ancestry?
Lots of research. It's going to take a lot of research, but it's worth it. It's going to be worth it. So, tips for researching your ancestry. So I did start with ancestry.com. I'm so sorry. Let me back up. I actually started with my family lore. So I went to my mom and I said, "Mom, mommy," I call her mommy, especially when I want something, mommy. Who all can you remember? Like, who are your, like, what? How far back does your memory go in terms of, who we are, and our family? And so I wrote down, what she, as much as she had, which it wasn't much. Like, she only knew. So from her dad, my grandfather, she only knew her great great, my great great grandparents. So she only knew like Grandpa Manuel, Grandma Manuel, Grandpa Stafford, Grandma Stafford, and Grandma Curtis. And like, so she only had what, two generations, I think, in her memory, for who was who, that she could like verbally tell me. And then when I went to my Aunt Irma had a little bit more, and my Aunt Mildred had a little bit. But then, they really, there were a lot of secrets in my family. So there's a lot of things that, they were like, "We're not going to tell you everything, kid. We're not." My great aunt, Catherine, literally said to me, "I'm not going to tell you my family secrets." I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. I'm just trying to find us. I'm just trying to find who we are." But she was like, "I'm not telling you, like, kid. I'm not telling you." So I went to my family first, and that's my first tip. My first suggestion is to go to your eldest family member and ask them everything they know about who's who and where they were born, as much as you can get, their names, descriptions as well, because a lot of the past records go by descriptions of someone, of people
That's
as
a good
well. Yeah.
point. That's
So
a really good tip.
you'll see court records saying, I knew Clifford Stafford, and he is a mulatto of tall stature, right? A tall man who, so they'll describe people. That's because if they're quote unquote illiterate, or if they weren't writing records down, they go by description. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is write it all down. Write down everything that you have, take pictures of it, give it to another family member so they don't have to start over.
Good point.
That's definitely something else. And then once you have as much as you can start with yourself, going to ancestry.com, your father and your mother, and then everything that the other people didn't have, start filling it in. So if your father had the wrong birth date, put down the quote of what his right birth date, like what it was, and then you go to their parents. And so that's four, right? Third, three generations down. And then everything that you can about your great grandparents, you write down everything, where they were from, where they were born, and then you just keep going. And so, the really important part about that is filling in the details, because family members don't always have everything correct.
This is true.
We have as
No, we
much as
know.
possible, as much as we can. Have, but we're not everything is correct. And then the records themselves are not always correct. So cross-referencing what you have on ancestry.com with physically going into one of the county registrars or county records halls, a hall of records, wherever you are, in this country, and going to that place and cross-referencing what you have. And then once you find out as much as you can about the eldest ancestor, where they're from, then you go and you find out what are the tribes in that area. What are the relations in that area?
What's the history and the history of the area as well?
That's right.
What's the history of the area? What was trying to be erased? What were they erasing in that area? I always love to find, I'm whenever I go, people, I've gotten some interesting looks, but whenever I go, so when I was researching my book on Nina Simone, and Nina Simone claims her Indianness. Like she claims that one of her great great grandparents was a full blood Indian grandfather.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I'll look back. It's in the first part of her her autobiography of Nina Simone.
Okay. Oh wow!
I put a spell on you. It's in like the first pages of it. And so when I was looking up the history of Tryon, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. There's only one American Indian mentioned, but he was technically a traitor because he helped some of things happen. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting off topic.
No, this is fascinating, though.
but this is the part where, like, if they're not talking about the American Indians in that area, how can you find the real information about the tribes in that area if your people are from that area? Because if your mom or dad or great grandmother or grandfather says you were part Indian, it's usually the people in that area that aren't being mentioned in some of those records.
And if you're told that something doesn't exist, then I'm really going to go find it. When you tell me, oh, that doesn't exist, thank you very much. It does. I'll go find it myself.
Basically, I'm like, oh, so where are your state records? You know, because you can find the state records as well. State records. So every county, starting from 1790, had to keep their own records, even if they were sparse. And so they're like those gigantic books, the really huge, dusty books. You can find them. They have them.
Those are fun to go through.
So
I like
fun.
How you said that. What was trying to be erased? That's like the question. When you frame it that way, it's almost like that's a great guiding star in a way of your research.
You can also ask, did any of the courthouses burn down around?
Yes.
Because they
That's another problem.
Purposefully were setting certain courthouses on fire that had any land records from Indians, American Indians, and then also free people of color. And they would call like one of the, what would they call it? If it was like in a, I don't know their title, director or whoever was in charge of records. And they would say, hey, you should take some records out, but you know, there's going to be a fire tonight.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is like, that's terrible.
Yeah. I think you have to be careful too when people, let's go back to family lore real quick. When in your family, like the joke now is, oh yeah, everybody's got Cherokee. And you know what? Sometimes people don't, but if people have been saying it for a long time, I think it's worth it always to just look
at
double
it.
Check. And so in my family, they kept saying it, and I've been researching for 20 something years. I was like, I'm not finding that. And I'm not finding anything like that. And it wasn't until someone took a DNA test matching me, where someone in that family had done some extensive research, very well documented, and they were right. And all of the older relatives that told me when I first started out, they're all gone now. But at our family reunion, this will be a surprise, but I'm going to let them know all of our elders were right. I actually did find it. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but
that's fantastic.
And it's been repeated. I think it's always worth it to just prove it out. And also to take a DNA test.
Absolutely. Yep. And Shonda, for our listeners, like their edification, you mentioned that you're from Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan. What is your family's, sort of migration pattern? You do touch on it a little bit in the book, but just so they kind of know regionally where we're like kind of talking.
So I researched back 11 generations from my ancestors of the Kehari, the Eastern Band Cherokee, and then this is all on my mom's side. And then also my great aunt kept some records as well and some family photos where one of my great 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 grandmothers was listed as a full-blood Delaware Cherokee, but she's later also mentioned as Pequot. So it's like Delaware Cherokee and Pequot. So 11 generations back, we originated, or from what I found, we originated in the Southeast. So that would be the North Carolina area. North Carolina, and again, when I talk about the erasure of some of the lines, Elizabeth County is a location that no longer is like not a prominent location, but Elizabeth County, Northampton County, those are the areas for us. And then there's Halifax, and then also Halifax. So those are the North Carolina areas. So my family, from different branches, did a couple of things. They left before they were the five civilized tribes were put on the Trail of Tears. And so for those who don't know, the Trail of Tears originated, actually the first, when it first started, it was 1828. A lot of people have the date as 1830. 1830 is when it was put into effect in earnest. And from 1830 to 1832, is when they completed the removal of the five civilized tribes in the southeastern area, in moving them to Oklahoma and Alabama.
Wow.
It's a terrible, terrible, the Cherokee Salagi, they call it the trail where they cried, the Great Walk, right? Mm-hmm. So my people left because they saw the signs, you know, they saw what was happening, and a lot of them left their reservations and they got on the Appalachian Trail, the Appalachian Trail and the highway, the King's Highway, are two trails that people took when they were leaving the Southeast, and they would go to Tennessee and then Kentucky and then Ohio, because they're seeking, and we don't realize this, they're seeking farmland, they're seeking places where they could be left alone, right?
Right.
And so they were on those trails. Ohio was that's Ohio Indian country, right?
Right, right.
A lot of us don't think about that. And then my people settled in Indiana, and it's so interesting to see that it's almost like they were all traveling together, like my Manuals and my Staffords and my Curtises,
you know, just
traveling, you know, together. Indiana. And then Michigan is where my Roberts and my Staffords. So it's interesting because my people started some of the first free people of color settlements in Michigan and southwestern Michigan as well. So it's so interesting to find this history. As a kid, I'm like, why? I should be a princess in my school. Like, there should be like a plaque named after the Staffords and the Manuals. I'm like, wait a minute. Custard has nothing to do with the Southeastern, like, you know, come on now. Like, it's so funny when I think about it. I'm like, wait a minute, they're telling their own stories. The victors are telling their own stories.
Yeah.
Because we quote unquote lost the war. Our stories don't get told. And I am not about that. I am about, oh no, I'm telling. Like, that is my job. My job is to bring this forth and to tell every story that I find, every hidden narrative that I find, I am telling it. So Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan is where I was born and raised.
Wow. I, and not to deviate too much off the topic, but when you said about seeing the signs, that's really interesting how there's always these times in the human experience where these tragedies happen, these horrors happen. And I remember reading like years ago an article about people who left before the Holocaust officially happened, and they said the same thing, that they saw the signs and they took heed and just they fled. And so it's just interesting, the parallels of just the human experience. So when you said that, I thought about that. I didn't even think about how, you know, there were people there who probably did see like the politics that was going on and like what was starting to go down and, you know, just the red flags that were starting to pop up, that they were like, okay, we got to get out of here. And then look at what ended up happening. So that's a really powerful.
You know, it's interesting when they left the reservations, they got taken off of the rolls. So
you did mention that. Yes, please go into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when the indigenous folks, my people, and you know, anyone when they left, you know, the blood stayed the same, but you got taken off of the count. So, so you couldn't be counted. And if you had, if you were not on the rolls when they started forcing people out, the five civilized tribes out, then you could not get back on those rolls unless you, somebody vouched for you. unless someone said, you know, oh, that's my cousin, or they were married, you know, unless someone vouched for you. And then other times you actually could not get back on the rolls, on the Indian rolls, even if you had like, if someone vouched for you. So, but it was a two-way street. Like some people were like, don't leave. You know, some of the people on the reservations and the preserves, they were like, no, don't leave. And other folks was like, I'm taking my family and I'm gonna look for better land, better pastures, better treatment. I think it's a very sad thing that you, that part of it is incredibly sad, because you essentially left everything behind. Yeah. You know, I have a poem in one of my books, books of poetry, called Who's Afraid of Black Indians? And one of the poems, I say, they could have left something, you know, for us to follow, like a deer bone, a wagon wheel, something to trace the history, you know, to find our people. But yeah. it wasn't like that. It was like, we're going to go over here. We're going to leave the state. We're going to go to this state and we're going to find a place where they will let us just be, just let us alone and let us just prosper. Peace.
Yes.
And leave us in peace. And that didn't always happen.
Wow.
We're coming behind them, finding the information and telling their stories. And this is what I say to young people, really anyone who will listen. There is nothing boring about history.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nothing boring about it. And it can be sad. You can find some information you could find. There's a little bit of joy. You know, I'm talking about my second great grandmother's slave narrative that exists for her. And it's so sad, but then there's a moment of joy when she's speaking about her wedding. And I'm going, wow, they actually allowed her to have a wedding, but you could hear the joy. And then after that, it's like, okay, what? I'm enslaved. I'm not free.
Right.
But you find the pockets of beauty. Yeah, you find those pockets and it's like, I'm human and I'm enjoying a human moment, you know? Yeah.
Right.
I think that's a beautiful story.
Wow. Yeah, that her story with her ancestors' slave narrative is a wonderful story indeed. But yeah, you know, studying history really is studying like the human experience, essentially, you know?
I love it. I can't get enough of it. I should have been a historian.
It's never too late. I mean, you are.
You know what? You're right, Chair Connor. You are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even just, you know, this short time, you know, you gave a lot of information and tips and history. So I would say you can go ahead and claim that.
Thank you for that. I know some historians, they'd be like, you didn't go to school for that. You don't have your PhD in history. I'm like, no, but I've probably researched more than them. And
exactly.
You know what I mean? I've been on that.
Exactly.
I could have gotten my PhD.
Listen, well, around these parts, you're a historian. So
Thank you very much.
Now, how do you think, and we talked about this a little bit, how do you think the country's history of dealing with mixed race identity has impacted the identity of those of us who identify as African-American today?
Gosh, that's such a great question. I think the anti-miscegenation laws set in place the fracture of our identities. But we have to go back in history. We have to go back to the Spaniards and how the Spaniards started the classification system first and foremost. So the Spaniards were the ones who were creating the octoroon, you know, you know what I mean? Like the mestizo, like those kinds of things. And that European classification laid itself on top of the treatment of the Black slaves particularly the Black women who had the white master's, you know, kid and the Mandingo, quote unquote, this is the stereotype of the Mandingo or the African who had kids with the white woman. And so, but it was like, even though it was basically a child of mixed race heritage, they had to pass a law to make a child born of a Black woman, that the child born of a Black slave Black woman slave.
Was a slave, yep.
Would be a slave, would be property, because that child was half white and that child could inherit the master's property.
That's right.
Right? So they had to figure out a way to keep, to draw the line. So putting that classification system on top, and then those anti-miscegenation laws just ripped us apart, you know, in a lot of ways, in terms of claiming family, in terms of misidentifying purposefully, yeah, the passing part, you know, saying whatever you had to say to provide for your family. And if every 10 years, this happened to a couple of my ancestors, every 10 years on the US census, they were a different ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, what can, mm-hmm, I, what should I, how I can identify as this, and but can I work, you know, can I work and feed my family?
Right.
So I think mixed raciality, that sensibility of how we have looked at race came from that. I also think it comes from that sense of privilege, you know, like the light skin, the more light skin you are as a mixed race person, and this is across the board. So you could be Black and white, you could be Latina and white, you could be Asian and Black, right? The lighter, mm-hmm, you are, for some reason, colorism
still exists
and, yep, plays a role, and impacts our psyche. It plays a role in how we live, how we think, how we act,
yep,
how we judge, you know. So it really did a number on us. And even now, I mean, you know, when I have had friends who have said to me, you know, you're not, you know, you don't have those Black features, like you're not fully Black. And I'm like, what?
Wow.
Literally. And I'm like, what did you just say? What just came out of your mouth? You're not my friend. You're not my friend.
Yeah.
Because of it's not like my physicality is not a thing that I did. You know, it's a thing that society, my parents and my grandparents and great grandparents, they just loved each other. You know, it was like, but then society is like, you can love each other, but you cannot exist without being, like the word that comes to mind is you cannot exist without being persecuted. Like that comes to mind. You cannot exist as a mixed person in this country without some kind of consequence.
Wow.
So,
wow.
That's we deep. Still have work to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We have a lot of work to do. When I talk to young people, so I give talks I do like preschool all the way up to seniors. So I've done kindergarten. I'm like teaching kindergartners how to like sing African and American Indian songs. Amsterdam. Yeah. When I go out of the country, I do the same thing. I'm like, okay, everybody, we're going to sing an African song to honor our ancestors. Right.
Wow. I'm like, that's wonderful.
So, but when I do these talks, I start them thinking about, what is an ancestor? Do you know where you came from? Do you know who your ancestors are? And I have young people. Oh, and the other thing is, I say, how many of you think you have two or three different races or ethnicities? Those fifth graders and fourth graders' hands will go up, and I'm like, so what are your people? And they're like, well, I'm Malaysian, and I'm French, and I'm, so they already know, like they're already thinking about identity and race and ethnicity, right? Yeah. It's our jobs as educators and as writers and as thinkers to let that be okay, to help them think that, oh, it's okay that I'm a multitude of races and I have this, I don't have to be racialized, right? It's okay that I have these corresponding and coexisting races. It's our work to do that. As a society, this needs to be inbred into the education system. And if I become the director of the education department, the Department of Education, and you know, there would be so many changes that really allow for identity and race and ethnicity to be accepted on multiple levels. That's a conversation that can help our youth, I think, and our elders, and all of us.
Yeah,
exactly. Yes.
Yeah, right. You're absolutely right.
So, Shonda, what are some parting words you would like to share with our listeners?
It's over already. Oh my gosh, this went by so fast.
I know, we've been having fun.
Parting words. Never let anyone tell you who you are. Right? Never let anyone take away your history, your heritage, your lineage. You know, you can find the documents and, you know, keep the documents if you want to make sure to prove to people who you are, but you don't have to prove to people who you are. You know, it's in your blood. And that was a lesson I had to realize, because I used to carry around my documents to powwows, you know, just in case anyone challenged me, for because I'm a powwow dancer too. And I sing on American Indian drums. And I think after 3 or 4 years, I stopped carrying the papers, my documents around. And I was like, you know what? It's in my blood, and it's in my spirit, and it's in my head. And if anyone wants to talk about that, we can have a good conversation about it.
Yeah.
But I don't have to prove to anyone who I am. I know. And that's what's important.
Absolutely. Mm.
Powerful. Shonda, thank you so much for hanging out with us and sharing with us and our listeners. We had a great time talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I had a great time too. Thank you.
I'm so happy to hear that. Please let our listeners know where they can find out more about you.
So my website, of course, shondabuchanan.com, shondabuchanan.com. And then also my newsletter. I have so much more information in my newsletter. I'm trying to put a lot of it in my Instagram as well. So Instagram is another place that people can find me. I check Instagram more than Facebook, but feel free to Facebook me too. So those are places to find me.
Okay. Can confirm she's active on Instagram. I follow
her. Yes.
To our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.